Chapter 21. The Three Untouchables. There are some people so devastatingly frank that their advent in any small, self-centred group long accustomed to seeing itself only through its own eyes has an effect as of tearing off a veil. Banerjee was of this type. It was therefore to be expected that his arrival at Kishenganj a week later would lead to a series of incidents which, though Anand and Mai seemed to find them only amusing, seriously disturbed the complacency of her followers. The first incident did not, of course, occur immediately. After his recent unpleasant experiences in Calcutta with His Holiness, who had taken revenge upon him for Mai's defection, he was at first glad simply to enjoy the friendly, even convivial atmosphere of the mango grove. Pandit G, moreover, knew well how to impress the young, and it was not long before Banerjee, who listened spellbound to the wily old scholar's discourses on Buddhism and the Vedanta, enthusiastically declared that he resembled the forest-dwelling sages of old. With Sudhir, who spent most of the day sleeping naked in the sun, he was soon on terms of familiarity. Friendships, as a rule, ripen quickly in India. Banerjee's eagerness to please, Panditji's desire to impress, and Sudhir's wish to be allowed to doze undisturbed, were in themselves sufficient to ensure amicable relations. All three, moreover, were Bengalis, and though Banerjee refused to admit the fact, the others had, even before his arrival, inferred from his name that, like themselves, he was a Brahmin. Food, and all that relates to its preparation and consumption, occupying as it does a place of unique importance in the life of the orthodox Hindu, it was inevitable that Banerjee's first conflict with the ashramites should have been in connection with lunch. At Anandamayi's invitation, Panditji, Sudhir and I had been staying on at the ashram after the morning session and taking this meal there. Space seemed to be limited, and I was not astonished when I was asked to squat on the north veranda of the main building while Panditji and Sudhir took their places in the long row of devotees on the veranda of the kitchen, a separate building immediately opposite. After a few minutes, the woman who had turned round to look curiously at me on the day of my arrival bustled up with two leaf plates, one of which she placed in front of me, the other a couple of feet away. After seeing that I had been served with rice, lentil soup and curried vegetables, she took her place beside me. As she was of a communicative disposition, I soon learned that she was not Kashmiri, but an Austrian, Blanka Schlamm, that she was the principal of a girls' school in Benares, and, being greatly devoted to Anandamayi, she was now spending her summer vacation at the ashram. When the meal was over, she brought me water for washing the hands, removed our two leaf plates, smeared the corner of the veranda where we had eaten with cow dung, and then washed it thoroughly with water. As she always looked after me, and as, apart from the girl who served us, no other ashramite spoke to me, we soon became friends. On the first day that Banerjee, too, was invited to stay for lunch, the question arose where he should sit. Panditji, for some reason or other, was strangely insistent that he should join him and Sudhir on the kitchen veranda. Banerjee refused to be separated from me. As they spoke in Bengali, I could not follow their argument, but both, I thought, had become unreasonably heated. Eventually, my friend seemed to gain his point, and a third leaf plate was laid on the north veranda. Only when we were again in the mango grove, and when Panditji and Banerjee, who had argued violently all the way back, simultaneously tried to explain to me their respective points of view, did I discover that the matter was more serious than I had suspected. Though I had been kept in ignorance of the fact, the ashram was rigid in its observance of caste distinctions, especially as between Brahmins and non-Brahmins. All could, indeed, sit together in the hall, and all could join in the singing of the divine names. But the members of a lower caste were not permitted to eat with members of a higher caste. The significance of the two verandas was now obvious. Blanca and I were being treated as untouchables. She threw away our leaf plates herself because no one else would have touched them. The cow dung was meant to purify the veranda after we had polluted it by eating there. Banerjee was furious that Panditji had allowed me to be treated in this insulting manner. The old man, though agreeing that caste distinctions were absurd, was irritated that Banerjee, instead of quietly adapting himself to circumstances, had openly flouted the conventions of the ashram, thus creating an awkward situation for Panditji himself, and compromising, perhaps, the Vahini's chances of securing Anandamayi's patronage. In the end, wearied by Banerjee's vehemence, Panditji adopted a milder tone and related a long story of how he himself, more than half a century earlier, on returning home from his first trip to America, had been compelled to stay in the cowshed for a week and undergo numerous ceremonies of expiation and purification before being readmitted to commensality with his kinsfolk. Did not the fact that such penalties were no longer imposed on those who ventured to cross the Kala Pani, the black water, he demanded, skilfully returning to his point, indicate that caste restrictions were on the decline? Indeed, the day of their final disappearance, being in any case close at hand, should we not endeavour to hasten it by a tactful and sympathetic handling of those who still adhered to the old socio-religious taboos, rather than retard it by provoking a reaction? These arguments were not without their effect on my friend, who, from the minute Panditji adopted a more conciliatory attitude, had begun to repent of his hasty actions and harsh words. He therefore apologized profusely for his rudeness. Panditji delivered a little sermon on the necessity of compromise, and by the time we set out for the ashram to attend the evening program, peace had been, for the time being, restored to the mango grove. But no argument could shake Banerjee's determination to eat with Blanca and me, and despite Panditji's disapproval, and to the infinite scandal of the ashramites, who, for all his disclaimers, knew he was a Brahmin, he continued to make a third with us on the north veranda, whence he cracked, for their benefit, embarrassing jokes about the three untouchables. Anandamayi being so obviously the queen bee of the ashram hive, we could not help speculating about the nature of her personal attitude towards the caste system. Panditji assured us that, being in a state of constant communion with the Absolute, wherein all mundane distinctions are transcended, she certainly could not be considered as really believing in it. The ashram rules, as far as he knew, had been framed by Anandamayi's chief disciple and manageress, Guru Priya, a woman of the narrowest and most rigid orthodoxy, who was even then hastening to Kishanganj from Benares. Besides, he pointed out, however mistaken Anandamayi's Brahmin disciples might be, it would be wrong for her to hurt their feelings by offending their caste prejudices, since, if out of disgust they left her, their spiritual development might be retarded. But what about the feelings of the non-Brahmins? Demanded Banerjee. Aren't they entitled to some spiritual development too? At present they don't come to the ashram, because they won't tolerate being treated worse than dogs. The balance seemed too heavily weighted in favour of the Brahmins for Panditji's arguments to sound convincing, and despite the air of long-tried patience the old opportunist assumed, we resolved to take up the matter with Anandamayi herself at the earliest opportunity. This was not long in coming. Having heard from her disciples that Banerjee was really a Brahmin, The blissful mother asked him whether, as was the orthodox custom, he wore his sacred thread and recited the Gayatri mantra thrice daily. This, we learnt later, was a standard question, for she was strongly in favour of the strict observance of these practices by all Brahmins. The conversation being in Bengali, I was unable to appreciate the full force of Banerjee's reply. But he told me the gist of it afterwards, and from the outraged expressions that appeared on the faces of some of the disciples, I could even then guess its tenor. Without admitting in so many words that he came from a Brahmin family, he spoke in the most disparaging terms of that rope, as he called the sacred thread, saying that he had thrown it away long ago and had no intention of ever wearing it again. Besides, he was a Buddhist, having taken the 3 refuges and 5 precepts on the last Vaishakha Purnima day, and Buddhists did not believe in caste. As for the Gayatri mantra, the hearing of which by members of the lower castes was in ancient days punishable in a ghastly manner, he had taught it to a number of sweepers and made them recite it. If Anandamayi was a real Mataji, a real holy mother, he declared belligerently, she would not be so interested in trying to find out who was a Brahmin and who was not, but regard all equally as her disciples and children. Whether this was the famous occasion on which he declared roundly that to him she was not a Mataji, but only an old Calcutta Kali Ma, that is to say, a low-caste fortune-telling medium, and that he had seen hundreds like her standing in the gutter waiting for customers, I do not remember. In any case, he had already said enough to infuriate the Ashramites, who had punctuated the latter part of his tirade with angry shouts of protest. Panditji looked intensely uncomfortable. Anandamayi, however, who had been listening with the utmost unconcern, only laughed in her most captivating manner at his last outrageous words. What explanation she finally gave of her attitude towards the caste system was never clear, and though Banerjee recurred to the subject in subsequent conversations, she could not be brought to admit either that she approved or that she disapproved of the restrictions observed in the ashram. Each time she extricated herself by adroitly covering philosophical evasiveness with an exercise of personal charm. The latter was of so extraordinary a quality that our dissatisfaction at her failure to give an unambiguous reply to our main question always ended by being subtly dissolved in the delight we could not help feeling in her fascinating presence. This was no doubt precisely her intention. Quite soon after my arrival at Kishanganj, I noticed that she seemed to carry on with her disciples, male or female, young or old, a sort of spiritual flirtation. Such a procedure was quite in keeping with the ideals of Bengal Vaishnavism. Krishna had lured the cowgirls of Vrindavan, not with philosophy, but by his flute, charmed them not by his wisdom, but with his beauty. And they had gained emancipation, according to the Vaishnava scriptures, not through understanding, but through love. So highly charged was the atmosphere surrounding Anandamayi, of so many eyes was she the cynosure, that her slightest word, look, or gesture could give rise to repercussions and become the subject of animated discussion for days and weeks afterwards. Devotees to whom she playfully tossed a flower almost swooned with emotion. Any special favour shown to one disciple threw the rest into paroxysms of jealousy. One neglected devotee, we were told, not so very long before, had out of chagrin actually assaulted Anandamayi and knocked her down a flight of steps. Not even Banerjee was prepared to go to such lengths as these in order to obtain an answer to our question. With our doubts periodically silenced by her captivating behaviour, but not permanently satisfied, We had no alternative but to infer Anna de Mailly's attitude towards caste from her actions, as well as from the actions of those who, since they derived their authority from her, might reasonably be supposed to be carrying out her directions. We soon discovered that, after being divided from the non-Brahmins, the Brahmins themselves were subdivided into three groups, each of which ate separately. What the principle of this subdivision was, I do not remember, but Anna de Mailly ate only in the presence of the first-class Brahmins, one of whom, usually either the untidy girl attendant or Guru Priya, had to feed her. After lunch, the blissful mother often sat on the front veranda of the ashram, where it was coolest. If she called for a glass of water, non-Brahmins had to withdraw for a few minutes while it was poured down her throat. So much was it possible, even for one who did not believe in them, to be influenced by the atmosphere of the place where such restrictions were observed, that when, once, I was allowed to remain, either because I was not sitting too near Anna de Mailly, or because my unclean presence had gone unnoticed, I actually felt quite elated. Blanca, who punctiliously withdrew on such occasions, stoutly maintained that Anna de Mailly had no personal objection to drinking anything touched by a non-Brahmin, affirming that she had herself once offered her water. But the Ashramites pronounced this story apocryphal, and in any case, even if true, the incident was so much the exception to the ashram's prevailing practice as to be of little consequence. As the only European resident in the ashram, poor Blanca was in fact the chief victim of orthodox malice. Several Brahmin youths, members of the inner circle, took a vicious pleasure in cruelly humiliating her on every possible occasion. Though she was twice their age, her devotion to Anna de Mailly usually enabled her to bear their insults with meekness, but occasionally she exploded. Once, when one of her tormentors, a tall, fleshy young Bengali with a puffy, discontented face, was filling a bucket at the kitchen pump, Blanca happened to set her cup, which she was waiting to fill, on the top of the cement post, a few inches above the mouth of the pump. "Now I'll have to throw all the water away," he shouted angrily, suiting his actions to the words. "But you only wanted the water for your bath," wailed Blanca, as the water swirled round her bare ankles. Muttering furiously to himself in Bengali, the youth clanged the bucket down in front of the pump. "Let me fill my cup first," pleaded the sorely tried woman. But with a venomous look, the youth told her to go away before she caused any more trouble. As it took half an hour to draw a bucket of water, it would be a long time before Blanca could fill her cup, and she was in a hurry. After 15 minutes, when the bucket was half full, she could bear it no longer. With a lusty Germanic imprecation, she suddenly gave her tormentor a shove, lifted his bucket to one side, and before he could recover from his astonishment, had filled her cup and marched off. This incident I witnessed from the garden in front of the ashram. About another, which took place in the latrines at the back, Blanca herself told me. The mother of the same youth, who had forgotten to take in with her the usual pot of water, was shouting to the women outside to bring one. Blanca obligingly did so. But when she heard Blanca's voice, she refused to open the latrine door for the water, and called out to another woman to fetch it instead. Blanca ruefully commented that her touch had made the water so impure that it was unfit for washing even the posterior of a Brahmin. Banerjee's temperament being what it was unlikely that he should endure the ashram's restrictions as meekly as Blanca usually did. Besides, there was a world of difference in their respective positions. A verse in the Ramacharita Manas of Tulsidas, the Bible of the Hindi-speaking people of northwestern India, declares that a Shudra, a member of the fourth or lowest caste, should be despised even though possessed of all virtues. while a Brahmin, though committing all sins, should be worshipped. Blanka was not even a Shudra. She was a Mleka, lower than even the lowest untouchable. However devout or spiritually developed she might be, she could not touch water or cooked food without polluting them. Banerjee, on the other hand, however bitterly he might rail, or however violently he might rebel against the taboos of orthodox Hinduism, remained in the eyes of Anandamayi and the Ashramites a Brahmin, and for all his protests, as such they insisted on treating him. Since in modern, that is to say, post-medieval India, it is practically impossible for a male Brahmin to repudiate his caste, no attempt at social reform, which in effect means the total abolition of the caste system, on the part of well-intentioned individual Brahmins, or indeed on the part of any caste Hindu, can be of more than theoretical significance. Hence it was that Banerjee could utter with impunity blasphemies for which Blanka would have been expelled from the ashram. He could maintain not unfriendly relations with the redoubtable Guru Priya, a middle-aged female ascetic with a mass of tousled grey hair and the expression of a bulldog, with whom he at times behaved with such boisterous familiarity that her grim features relaxed almost into a smile. In fact, he was on the whole tolerated, if not indulged, like a child who, for all his waywardness, is still a member of the family. Leavings of food, or food that has in any way touched the lips, is called jhuta, and no orthodox Hindu would consent to touch the jhuta of a person of inferior caste. Food that has been ritually offered before the image of a divinity, to a saint, or to a teacher, or highly respected elder, is termed prasad. Among the ashramites, competition for Anandamayi's prasad was keen, and every day after lunch the untidy young attendant, momentarily a person of importance, would be besieged by importunate devotees as soon as she emerged from the kitchen with a few scraps left over from the blissful mother's meal. Sometimes there was no prasad, for Anandamayi, who by allowing herself to be given larger helpings could have supplied all the ashramites with prasad every day, evidently understood the art of increasing the demand by keeping down the supply. To be sent a morsel of food directly from her own plate, at her personal behest, was a signal mark of favour, occasioning intense joy in the recipient, and equally intense jealousy in everyone else. When, one day, while the three untouchables were lunching on the north veranda, prasad was brought with the awe-stricken comment that Anandamayi herself had sent it, we were obviously expected to be quite overwhelmed by such gracious condescension. The ashramites had yet to know Banerjee's strength of mind. "I'm not going to touch that woman's jhuta," he said roughly, covering his plate with his hand. "How do I know she hasn't got some foul disease?" Incidents of this kind happened frequently. One of the most amusing took place not in the ashram but at Dehradun, in the house of a devotee. All the ashramites, together with everyone in the neighbourhood who was in any way connected with, or interested in, or even likely to be interested in Anandamayi, had been invited to a feast. Anandamayi, as far as I remember, either did not come, or came but did not eat anything. Banerjee and I were seated side by side, Panditji and Sudhir elsewhere. As the custom is in India, the guests sat on the floor in long rows, men being segregated from women and children. In front of each person was a leaf plate. The place on the other side of Banerjee, the last in our row, was empty. We had just been served and were about to begin eating, when a late arrival, an elderly man wearing a sacred thread, sat down in the empty place. Hearing Banerjee and me talking in English, he leaned forward and gave me a suspicious stare. What he saw was apparently not reassuring, for he started fidgeting uneasily. Finally, bending towards Banerjee, he asked in a low voice, "What is your caste?" My friend looked up from his plate with a mischievous expression. "My caste," he repeated in a loud, cheerful voice. "I'm an untouchable." The old gentleman sprang up as though he had seen a cobra. Presently we saw him a few rows away, talking in an agitated manner to a group of Ashramites and pointing towards Banerjee. The Ashramites shook their heads. Evidently they were trying to explain that Banerjee was a Brahmin. A few minutes later, having been unable to find another vacant place, he returned and gingerly sat down again.
"Why didn't you tell me you were a Brahmin?" he demanded.
"I'm not a Brahmin. I'm an untouchable," again declared Banerjee, more cheerfully than ever. "After all, I should know my own caste." The old gentleman was so obviously torn between fear of possible pollution and fear of missing his meal that neither of us could help laughing. Eventually, with a long, dark look at Banerjee, he pulled the strip of matting at the end of the row out of alignment with that on which we were sitting, so that technically he would not be eating with us, and slowly started on what was evidently a far from enjoyable meal. With incidents of the type narrated occurring almost daily, it did not take Banerjee and me long to conclude that both Anandamayi and her more intimate followers not only tolerated, but actively encouraged the observance of the caste system in all its rigid exclusiveness. Our findings were later corroborated by the accidental discovery that both Anandamayi and Guru Priya wore sacred threads. Since the custom of investing female Brahmins with this insignia of caste status had died out more than 1,000 years earlier, the fact of its revival indicated orthodoxy of the most pronounced type. Besides, Guru Priya wore the saffron robes of an ascetic, and according to the best Hindu tradition, which we encountered subsequently in South India, ascetics, whether male or female, are casteless, the sacred thread being one of the articles consigned to the flames at the time of initiation. Nowadays, holy men and ascetics, especially in North India, are often found retaining both thread and caste, and the punctilious observance of caste restrictions, even among themselves, is customary. Membership of certain Vedantic orders is indeed restricted to Brahmins. Once, when half a dozen monks belonging to the Ramakrishna mission, members of which are known to eat even with Europeans, were given lunch at the ashram, we observed that they were carefully segregated from the more orthodox thread-wearing ascetics. Having succeeded in coming to a conclusion on the subject of Anandamayi's attitude towards the caste system, it remained for us to attempt a general estimate of her true nature. In the electric atmosphere of the ashram, charged with an intensity of devotion verging on hysteria, it was impossible not to form an opinion on this engrossing subject, even if only by way of a refusal to accept the opinions of others. Guru Priya, the crane-necked youth, the knight of the bucket, and the rest of the inner group asserted that Anandamayi was God Almighty in human form, and that the worship of Ma, for which they afterwards coined the word Maism, was the future religion of the world. Whether they made this staggering claim on Anandamayi's behalf because they belonged to the inner group, or whether they belonged to it because they made the claim, was a difficult question to determine. But I sometimes felt that an ashramite's spiritual development was held to be in direct ratio to the extravagance of his or her opinion of the Blissful Mother's true nature. Such mutual back-scratching of gurus and disciples is indeed so common in modern Hinduism that one cannot help wondering how much of the entire history of this religion is reducible to a congeries of dialogic processes, as the Orientalist Max Muller called them, taking place within the framework of a relatively static social order. Some members of the inner circle averred that there had only been two full incarnations of God, Krishna and Chaitanya. Anandamayi was the third. To the Buddha, to them a figure of quite minor importance, they grudgingly conceded the status of a partial incarnation. Anandamayi herself was extremely reticent about her true nature, though she never repudiated any of the claims put forward on her behalf by the Ashramites. But once, we learned, in response to the persistent questioning of Hari Baba, a thin, grey-bearded ascetic with a following of his own, whom we often saw at the ashram, she had declared that she was Purna Brahma Narayana, the absolute impersonal reality of the non-dualist Vedantins, plus the incarnating personal god of the Vaishnavas. She was also reported to have declared more than once that her present existence was not the outcome of actions committed in past lives, that she had enjoyed uninterruptedly since birth full realization of the truth, and that whatever sadhanas or spiritual exercises she had appeared to undergo had taken place spontaneously.